Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Hundreds of desperate refugees from North Africa have drowned this month after their overcrowded boats sank in the Mediterranean. The Italian Prime Minister is calling the Mediterranean the Sea of Death. This past weekend, there was another close call. More than 700 migrants traveling in five boats were rescued off the coast of Sicily by the Italian Navy and Coast Guard. The European Union's border agency says about 30,000 migrants have arrived in Italy from Africa during the first 9 months of this year. That's three times higher than the migration for all 12 months of 2012. News outlets report that the disasters at sea have sparked a wave of emotion and reopened the debate on the EU's migration policy. The richer northern countries like Germany and Sweden are at odds with southern countries where the migrants are first landing. The president of the European Parliament says member countries need to consider radical changes to the asylum policy. The European Parliament this month approved a new border surveillance program that the members have been working on since 2008. The European Commissioner promised Parliament that the Eurostar program will save lives once it launches in December. But skeptics say the program is designed to secure borders and not to help boats full of migrants that are in danger. On our program today, we'll hear from a migration policy expert from Brussels, a foreign correspondent in Rome, and the editor of a news website in Malta. But first, Worldwatch with Raymond Tungekar.
Tech giants Google and Yahoo are outraged over reports the U.S. National Security Agency tapped communications links that carry their users' data around the world. The Washington Post reports the agency is in a position to collect information from hundreds of millions of accounts, citing documents released by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden and interviews with officials. In a statement, Google's chief legal officer said, quote, "We are outraged at the lengths to which the government seems to have gone to intercept data from our private networks, and it underscores the need for urgent reform." The International Criminal Court is postponing the trial of Kenya's president after prosecutors said they needed more time to prepare their case. President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto are accused of inciting violence after Kenya's turbulent 2007 elections. Kenyatta's trial is now scheduled to start on February 5th. The bodies of nearly 100 migrants, mostly women and children, have been found in Niger's Sahara Desert. The group reportedly died of thirst after their vehicles broke down while traveling to Algeria. The victims are believed to have been escaping poverty and economic hardship in Niger. And that'll do it for this week's World Watch.
Malta is the focal point of the international immigration dilemma. And joining us today from the Mediterranean island is Matthew Vella, editor of MaltaToday.com. From Brussels, we have Elizabeth Collett of the Migration Policy Institute. And for the perspective from Italy, Wall Street Journal correspondent Christopher Emsden is on the line from Rome. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi.
So the Maltese Prime Minister reportedly said at a recent EU meeting that the large numbers of immigrants arriving on Malta's shores poses a challenge to the very survival of his country. Matthew, please describe what's happening in this, that huge stretch of water that Malta is responsible for.
I think I should, just before I really explain what's going on in the waters, I think I should precise that the statement that was quoted, of the Prime Minister, was obviously news for us over here. I mean, the rhetoric implies that Malta is facing a crisis, an emergency situation. I mean, it really depends on who you speak to. Mm-hmm. The numbers, you know, can be put into question. We believe there are only 5,000 asylum seekers or refugees actually living in Malta, because many of them actually go on to exit the country, usually illegally, and move on into the EU. So I would say that a more precise description would be less of a question of survival, but of a way to cope with the influx and the pressures it puts on the Maltese armed forces to basically secure its very vast search and rescue region. Malta has a very vast search and rescue region, which stretches from Tunisia, down in the south from Libya, and right up to almost Greece. So you can imagine that this island with its small patrol boats has to be responsible for rescue operations of any migrant boat in distress in this very vast stretch of water in the Mediterranean. The big question for Malta usually is whether it has to take in asylum seekers, and that usually depends on which is the country which is actually affecting the rescue of a group of asylum seekers in distress at sea. So the whole issue of survival is really tied to this really extreme circumstance in which the Maltese forces have to save asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. And then obviously there's the other question of mandatory detention, where you have migrants and asylum seekers detained up to at least, sometimes up to 12 months, sometimes even up to 18 months. That's depending on the length of their asylum claim.
Christopher, what's the view from Italy of the more recent tragedies and the broader implications?
I think Italy is now quite squarely in line, very much with the Malta point of view. We forget that Italy is about 300 times larger in population, and Malta is really in the middle of the Mediterranean, so even more exposed with a larger naval thing. Anyway, the popular view here on the street and somewhat of the government lately is that Mediterranean countries, especially Italy and naturally also Malta, are having an undue burden for migrants trying to reach Europe, not necessarily their own countries, because of their long coastlines, et cetera.
Right.
To some extent, that's true. Over the longer haul, I'm not sure that the numbers really bear that out, because a lot of people do come overland. So I think that what happened really is that October shipwreck really, because of the mass deaths involved, really sort of turned the subject on to a very high emotional level, which has raised the issue of what are the asylum policies, because apart from the fact of try to prevent death, the point is the minute you try to save them, currently, whoever saves them brings them to their land, their territory, and has to take care of them. And in the case of Malta, that's, obviously the country is not very large. In the case of the island of Lampedusa, it's also not very large.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I think it's criticisms that, in particular, Italy haven't done much over the last 10 years of these large-scale, frequent nighttime immigrant arrivals, hasn't done much to improve its processing and asylum rule. And so that draws sort of criticism from Northern European countries who feel like they're just trying to pass along the burden to, because they have been unable to deal with it.
Okay, and Elizabeth, let's widen the scope even farther. The Maltese Prime Minister also said this is a European problem, not just a problem for Italy or Malta. What's the wider scope of this immigration issue?
Well, I mean, this is definitely a European problem, and I think, it's right to understand that many of those people coming across the Mediterranean have no real intention of staying in Greece or Italy or Malta, but would wish to move to different countries, whether they have social connections there or whether they believe they would have their asylum claim more fairly assessed, as many might think. I mean, recently, Sweden announced that if Syrians arrive in Sweden, they will be granted asylum on the basis of the situation in Syria. So I think, that creates a desire amongst some, certainly, to try and reach Sweden. Overall, I think, this is something that is highly emotional, and it would be wrong to suggest any member states don't care deeply about what happens in the Mediterranean. But as Matthew pointed out, this is not a new phenomenon. This has been going on for a number of years, and in fact, while the numbers might be three times as high as they were in 2012, they have been much higher in the past, and they've been at different pressure points
right.
as well.
Because after the Arab Spring, there was a big influx, right?
There was. And before that, if you looked at the situation between West African migration to the Canary Islands and onto Spain and through Ceuta and Melilla, probably about 5 years ago now, there were significant numbers there as well. As Spain responded, those routes shifted further west towards Malta, Italy, and indeed Greece as well. And now we're starting to see some movements into Bulgaria and Romania. I think one of the big challenges here are on two levels. The first is the EU is not fully competent to respond on these issues. So the EU is not fully in charge of asylum policies. It sets a number of basic standards and rules, but it is up to the member states individually to manage their borders and to develop and ensure capacity and due process and the protection of both immigrants and asylum seekers at the national level. So there is a limit to how much the EU can do to resolve beyond encouraging member states, offering additional financing, and perhaps working with third countries. The second aspect of this is that member states, while they all care about the same issue, they don't necessarily define the problem in the same way. And I think what was very interesting about what Matthew said was the separation of the numbers question, how many people are arriving in each country, from the search and rescue burden itself. If you look at absolute numbers and relative numbers of asylum seekers across Europe, countries such as Germany and Sweden receive more asylum seekers every year. So their argument is, we have a larger number of asylum seekers than you, so don't tell us we're not living up to our responsibilities. But at the same time, the search and rescue, the very immediate issue of how to protect people taking very dangerous journeys across the Mediterranean, is probably a separate issue whereby those countries to the south really are taking on an additional burden. Now, the northern countries tend to approach this as, we will give you extra financial support, we will give you extra technical support, we also want to see your capacity improve. And southern countries say there's a limit to how much we can do on our own, especially given, as was pointed out, we will have to deal with those asylum seekers if they are picked up in the Mediterranean, regardless of who picks them up. Okay. We will then have to process those claims.
Well, let's go back to these journeys. Who are in these boats, and how far do they have to go generally, and how dangerous is it when they get in these boats and they're overloaded and they're not in very good shape? Elizabeth, could you take that on first, and whoever else wants to speak on that?
Sure. One of the challenges here is a concept that's a very technical concept, which is that these boats are filled with mixed flows. That is, some people are there to coming across to seek asylum. Particularly people from Syria, but also people from Eritrea, Ethiopia, even Mali, who are fleeing conflict. Uh-huh. People who are really trying to reach Europe for more economic purposes, mm-hmm. either to join families or to find a job. Then it's the responsibility of those member states to sort of sort those people into two piles and make sure everyone who needs to have an asylum claim assessed has that opportunity. And what's interesting about these routes is they change a year, but many of these people are coming a long distance. So you might find people coming from Pakistan, coming from Bangladesh, making their way overland and then finding their way into Libya and then moving up across the Mediterranean. And the second aspect of this is still more people don't make it onto boats. So countries like Morocco, Turkey, and Ukraine are increasingly becoming destination, not necessarily by choice, but because they're transit countries from which migrants then can't find a way to move on. Yeah. So they find themselves staying in these countries, waiting for an opportunity. And that then, I think, is becoming a significant issue for those governments who don't really know how to respond, most of whom don't have.
What happens to migrants that make it to Italy?
First, I want to just say that the previous comments about how transition countries exist. Italy is one of those. Italy was always a place where people passed through.
Yeah.
There are stories of, you know, trainloads full of people from Kurdistan 10 years ago, you know, moving north to France or Germany, sort of unnoticed by Italian authorities. A few more people have stayed over time, but the basic issue in Italy is that the asylum policy is quite weak. The procedure is very disorganized. So people are basically, the minute a migrant has landed on Italian soil, they've basically already committed a crime because the code here suggests that illegal immigration is a crime. So technically, they're already jailable. What happens, in fact, is that they're brought to a sort of a holding center, which is a fairly stark organization where their case will be handled. Some of them may apply for asylum, in which case they're applying for asylum in Italy, which may not be their desired destination. So some of them may wish not to do that. What also happens is, while technically Italy has the right and, in a sense, legal duty to itself to repatriate the people, what often happens is that the people are basically eventually given a piece of paper saying that they're not allowed to live in Italy, and then released from the holding center, and then they somehow managed to head north. Just 2 weeks ago, after the Lampedusa tragedy, about 20 Ethiopians were found trying to cross the Alps, and early snow happened, and they took refuge in a ski cabin where they were eventually apprehended by authorities. But they were trying to go north, obviously. They had managed to get all the way to the Swiss border, which is quite a long way from Sicily.
So they survived this dangerous journey over the Mediterranean, and then they have to go over to the snowy mountains.
As they say, they want to proceed usually to where they have kin or where they believe that they have a support network, usually linked to their ethnic community.
Yeah. And Matthew, in Malta, you wanted to touch on the dilemma that the politicians in Malta face. There's an EU policy, and then there's the policy that their their constituents want the elected officials to follow. Can you talk about that conflict?
It's subsumed beneath all this talk between European leaders who are, you know, they want changes to the Dublin regulation, they want more support, or they want resettlement of migrants in their countries. At the end of the day, southern European member states are responding to domestic concerns. So, for example, migration has long been a very hot issue in Maltese politics. The present Labour government, centre-left, so to speak, government, has long been an advocate, since its days in opposition for a few years back, has long been an advocate of a more hardline stance on immigration, which means getting the EU to resettle, to create a mandatory responsibility-sharing system so that more migrants in the southern European member states can be resettled into the northern states. Now, obviously, northern states will say, look, we have our own asylum seekers. In Sweden, for example, is probably one of the EU's, the country in the EU which takes the largest, probably, number of asylum seekers, at least in the last years. The Maltese government is responding to domestic concerns on the street, and those would be having to see less asylum seekers in Malta. Now, for example, in the last European Council talks, the EU leaders decided to have some form of operational measures in place by December 2013, before another migration summit in June of 2014. What I think those short-term measures would be, at least what the desirable measures would be from the Maltese and Italian perspective, would be some sort of organized removal system. That means for visa overstayers or migrants who are refused protection, and basically show their electorates that they are doing something to actually remove migrants who don't have a valid who were not given asylum. And I think that would really, politically speaking, that would really fall in line with the sort of keep them out approach. Mm-hmm. In the rhetoric that we've heard, to have a better border control force with Eurosur and Frontex monitoring the southern border of the EU.
Elizabeth, what do you think of that idea, and how receptive would the northern countries be to this?
I mean, I think, you know, the ability to return people is really at the heart of many of the difficulties in finding a solution. Countries fear receiving asylum seekers because they also fear not being able to return them should their claim not be accepted. Mm-hmm. And the same goes for migrants who arrive without documentation or authorization to work. And that really is one of the most enduring things in a politician's mind whenever he's agreeing to something. So the idea that you would relocate refugees around Europe is more palatable than relocating asylum seekers around Europe, because then the question becomes, well, what do we do if we can't return them? And many of these people are coming from countries where there is very difficult to return them home, because there's no documentation. The documentation has been destroyed en route because those sending and transit countries aren't necessarily willing to take back those people. And I think in some cases, even when an asylum claim hasn't been determined, there is genuine fear and lack of desire to return. And I think this sits at the heart of so many of these conversations, both with respect to the asylum debate and border management, and broadly talking about irregular migration.
And Christopher, is what are the politicians saying in Italy about this push and pull from the EU and from their own constituents?
I have to say that the Italian view about Europe is in general that there should be, quote, more Europe. And so they would like to see European Union authorities make new rules that apply to all. Then the politicians can sell it to the locals. As to what they really think, the current government is a coalition. On the right side of that coalition, I would say it's generally sort of the hard line, anti-immigrant parties that feel that are very unsympathetic to the modern notion of asylum seekers. They think asylum is just people who are fleeing from formally declared wars. And on the left, there are the left had expected to win the elections, and one of their first promises was to overhaul the immigration rules, including long-term access to citizenship here. But since they didn't actually win the elections and had to form a coalition, it's all sort of bogged down. Italy has a long way to go in terms of culturally preparing its people to deal with this. And it's just not a very interesting subject. So I think I'm afraid it's right to say that the politicians are using this argument to push for, quote, more Europe, which they also may want on other levels. And they aren't really stoking a meaningful move towards, for example, there are no proposals in Parliament for overhaul of the rules that would solve the emergency right now.
Right. And Elizabeth?
To talk about, I think if we're talking about populist influence and far-right influence, and particularly in Northern Europe, I think there are two drivers which don't necessarily cohere. The first is far-right groups that are increasingly popular across Northern Europe, whether it be Sweden, Netherlands, France, and even in the UK, there is a sort of influence at the national level to be more hardline, to take a more hardline position against immigration. But at the same time, many of these groups are also deeply Eurosceptic. So for them, the solution isn't to be found at the European level. And there's a slight conflict in ideology, because if you look at what the EU has been doing over the last decade and will continue to do, is it really talks about strengthening borders. It talks about dealing with asylum claims. It talks about returns. So if you want to find a solution that reduces immigration to Europe, the EU might actually be your best way to go. So resolving that conflict between Euroscepticism and immigration, I think, is one of the big challenges for far-right groups over the next decade, and one they haven't really resolved.
Okay. Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. This week, you can read an article on illegal immigration to Southern Europe that features an interview with a Red Cross worker in Malta, and an article about the political impact of immigration, including the surging of far-right parties across Europe. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter @globaljourn. Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you, just to change the subject a bit, have there been attempts to work with Libya and Tunisia to prevent ships from embarking?
There have been bilateral attempts between Italy and Libya going back some years. I think Chris might be able to speak more detail in more detail to that, which were generally condemned by other member states because they felt that the concessions that Italy were making, and they were effectively sanctioning violence towards immigrants and poor treatment towards immigrants in Libya. Now, with the change of regime and different government in Libya, the EU is now talking about how it can reach out and work with Libya. There are a number of projects ongoing, which are sort of security slash immigration slash border projects. And there is a discussion about how they might develop a deeper dialogue and one where they help Libya build up its own capacity to manage this, including asylum. That is an extremely long-term endeavour. That's not something that will happen this year or next year. It really is a long-term project, because I think building a partnership that is genuinely a partnership between the EU and a state that is so apparently unstable will take many, many years.
Chris, what do you think about this idea of
tackling
the problem?
Completely. I mean, Italy did do those bilateral treaties, and they've been largely unsuccessful. Obviously, right now, the north coast, or the sea coast of Libya, which is a huge country, is just not the Libyan authorities in the post-war setup are not able to, or claim not to be able to, and probably aren't able to properly patrol it. The other thing is that very few of the people ever seem to be Libyans themselves. So obviously, Libya is a recipient country of really long-distance people coming from Somalia and West Africa, et cetera. In fact, every once in a while, you know, trucks are found that have run out of gas in the middle of some incredibly hostile piece of desert, and basically the people die. So these are long-run, people-moving trains that Libya is an intermediary country. And so sort of like Italy 10 years ago, Libya is quite happy to see that people move right along as well, because they certainly don't want to host them. So any progress on that front, I would agree, is going to take a long time.
Okay.
I would have to add something that at the time of the Berlusconi-Gaddafi agreement, to have a pushback agreement, that came on the back of a $5 billion package for Libya. I can say for certain that Malta was a passive supporter of this policy, even though it did not express officially agreement or disagreement with this policy. And you have to also take into consideration that it didn't matter that the European member state was dealing with a dictator, and that this country is not a signatory of the Geneva Convention on the Rights of the Refugee. So we have to keep in mind that there's always this politically opportunistic way of dealing with migration. There's always this keep them out approach. Mm-hmm. In the way of controlling migration, rather than create some sort of legal avenue, because what we are seeing here, when everyone is talking about traffickers, criminal organizations, and trying to stop people from making this this journey across sea, this is a response to the high walls being erected by Europe in the first place. And it's really like it's just a business, you know. I mean, if there's an obstacle, there are people who are trying to make a buck over actually going around this obstacle.
Okay, we're gonna have to leave it there. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Joining me today on Global Journalist was Matthew Vella, editor of MaltaToday.com, Elizabeth Collett of the Migration Policy Institute, and for the perspective from Italy, Wall Street Journal correspondent Christopher Emsden. Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Victoria Mitsukute was this week's lead producer. Please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.